This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Hi, I'm Mark from Annandale, New Jersey.
I'm Eric from Durham, North Carolina.
I'm Charlie Todd from New York City.
The Sound of Young America is an independent production.
Supported by listeners like me.
If you'd like to support the show like I did,
visit MaximumFun.org
and click on Donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, it's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program, Gary Hustwit, is a documentary director whose first film, Helvetica, was about that most dynamic of subjects, the font. And his new film is a follow-up that takes the long view on the world of design, or the broad view, called Objectified, in which he interfaces with some of the biggest names in design to talk about what design is, how it's done, and why it matters. Gary, welcome to The Sound of Young America. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Jesse.
I want to start with Helvetica, a movie I really enjoyed and felt like I learned a lot from. I think if you went into a film financier's office, a film financier who was a film financier of documentary films, which admittedly have a marginal appeal on the face of it, and said, guess what I'm going to make a documentary about? A font.
I would have been laughed out of the room, probably.
Exactly. So what gave you the bravado to think that you could make a film about something so static and generally unappreciated?
I guess probably because I didn't think of it as static, and I really appreciated good graphic design and typography. And really just wanted to see a documentary about those things. So I guess I'm my own target market in a way. So I figured that if I wanted to see something like that, then there were probably other people out there who wanted to see it. And I couldn't believe that there hadn't already been a cinematic documentary about graphic design either. So once I kind of realized that, then I was just kind of obsessed and just had to make it.
What part of it made you think that it could make a film? What was special about the font Helvetica?
Well, you know, I live most of the time in New York City, and if you've ever ridden the New York City subway, that's the font that most of the signs are in. So it was just one of these things where, you know, just kind of, you know, commuting to work and looking around and kind of realizing how this one typeface was everywhere. But mostly Helvetica was kind of a structure that I could use to talk to a lot of graphic designers and type designers about what they do, because everybody sort of has an opinion about it, either for it or against it. So it was really a structure in a way. And it didn't hurt that it's everywhere. I mean, it's the logos of just hundreds and hundreds of different companies, and the U.S. government uses it for all the, you know, our tax forms and everything are in Helvetica. So that was one layer, I guess, of just like kind of this eye-opening moment of like, holy Christ, it's everywhere. But also then using it as a way to talk to typographers and graphic designers about what they do.
A font is sort of the ultimate design exercise because it is both so important and so meaningful, and both and also completely abstract. What part of the story of design did you feel like you could tell by looking at a typeface?
Well, you know, I think most people kind of really don't even notice the typeface of the text that they're reading. And there are so many different ways that type can express, you know, an emotion or an opinion or a slant, or not do that, or just kind of try to be invisible. And there are so many, at least I think, amazing people who do this, who spend, who slave over, you know, the tiniest little detail on the lowercase a, you know, how the top part of it's going to curve or something. And it's just this whole kind of, you know, world of people that really do think a lot about these things. So, you know, I kind of wanted to show that world, in a sense. And, you know, I think it's one of those things that once you notice it, once you notice, really think about the differences between different fonts, then you can't ever, you know, go back to not noticing it. I tend to like these subjects that, or these things that we take for granted. But then when you really look at them and or you talk to the people that just obsess over them all day long, then you see this whole kind of other world behind that thing.
Let's hear a quick clip from Helvetica. This is typographer Eric Speakerman.
Well, I'm obviously a typomaniac, which is an incurable, if not mortal disease. I can't explain it. I just like looking at type. I just get a total kick out of it. They are my friends, you know. Other people look at bottles of wine or whatever, or, you know, girls' bottoms. I get kicks out of looking at type. It's a little worrying, I must admit, but it's a very nerdish thing to do. I'm very much a word person. So that's why typography for me is the obvious extension. It just makes my words visible.
How did looking at all these questions within the context of typefaces start to change the way that you looked at other things in your life?
Well, for a while, it changed just the way I looked at anything because I couldn't stop looking at the font, which is, you know, I think it's referred to as typomania. It's a disease where you don't even read the message. You know, you try to identify what font it is before you even read what it's saying. So I spent 2 years during the making of Helvetica just looking for Helvetica. Wherever I went, just either to film it or you know, just out of habit. And that took me a while to really, that was a tough habit to kick.
At what point in that did you develop the ability to distinguish between Helvetica and Arial?
I think when I started the film, I definitely had like cheat sheets of Arial or Universe or Univers. Franklin Gothic, a few of the other ones that are close. After a while, there are just some really distinctive features to Helvetica, but also there's a feeling.
People get really angry about Arial.
Yeah, yeah.
I mentioned that I was interviewing you. I think I got four people sent me a message asking about Arial.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. But after a while, you know, there's a kind of a feeling that a typeface gives off, and that's what you end up picking up on when you start looking at them a lot. There's just a kind of a characteristic that Helvetica has that I can spot it, you know, a mile away now.
Once you got over your typomania, and possibly any other manias you may have had, such as Legomania. I'm trying to think of any other manias. Legomania, that's when you're a Legomaniac.
Pyromania.
Yeah, sure, pyromania. So once you got over these horrible mental conditions that you were suffering from, did you start to think about the process, the people behind the things that were in your life, the design of things?
You know, I think it definitely made me more aware of those things. Again, it's like looking at those things that you take for granted that you use every day, your toothbrush or your coffee maker or your, you know.
In fact, the film Objectified opens with a montage of someone waking up that focuses in on each designed object that they interact with over the course of that half an hour.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just before, between the time you wake up and when you leave the house, you've probably touched 100 different objects. And I invite people to try to count the number of things that you touch because it's crazy. And we're at the stage where we don't even really think about it or question it or give any consideration to, you know, how much of our environment is made up of manufactured objects, and therefore, well, you know, what about the people who make these things, and you know, how does what they do again sort of affect us in our daily lives? So, yeah, I just had this vision, I guess, of trying to show that in a montage, like how many things we really do come into contact with in an average day.
What were the questions you had as a non-designer, as a filmmaker and former journalist and whatnot? What were the questions you had about how things were made that you thought you could answer in a film?
Well, again, for me, a big part of it is process, is sort of watch, kind of getting behind the object and seeing kind of the story behind it. And hearing that story or the kind of inspiration for that design from the designer, I guess I'm sort of fascinated by that stuff, period. And then, you know, really looking at all the kind of stages that, you know, an iPhone or whatever, you know, a product like that, all the stages that it would go through from kind of, you know, conception to the shelves, but then also, you know, us, you know, as we used it, and then what happens after we use it, and how is that part of the design? How is the kind of disposal of this object factored into the design from the very beginning? There's so many things within that those relationships, consumerism, materialism, environmental issues, capitalism. I mean, everything is, and art and creativity, it's all wound up in there. So that's, I guess, I wanted to try to explore that in the you know, the structure of a 75-minute film.
Here's a clip from Objectified.
When you see an object, you make so many assumptions about that object in seconds. What it does, how well it's going to do it, how much you think it should cost. The object testifies to the people that conceived it, developed it, manufactured it.
Sometimes we know who these designers are, sometimes we don't. But anything that's touched by man, is transformed by man, is by its very nature design.
Ultimately, my job as a designer is to look into the future. You know, my job is about what's going to happen, not what has happened.
All these physical objects in our lives, there's no real critique on them. Very, very little discussion on how these things really, really affect us.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Gary Hustwit, whose new film is called Objectified. You talk with designers from all over the world in the film, and I'd like to talk a little bit about a few of them and their different approaches. You mentioned the design of the iPod or Apple. I think if there's any technology design thing, institution that reigns supreme, it's obviously Apple, who've built their business around design and aesthetics. I thought it was interesting that you talked with Apple's chief designer, or at least showed in the film talking with Apple's chief designer, as much about the process of making things as about the famous aesthetics of an iPod or a MacBook or something like that. He talks about the machinery behind it. Was that something that surprised you when you talked to him, that he wanted to talk about that?
Well, yeah, because I mean, I think that's a big part of the sort of secret of Apple, is that they spend as much time designing the kind of manufacturing systems that enable them to make the objects as they do designing the actual objects themselves. You can't have one without the other. You can't just wake up one day and decide to make the MacBook Air without first designing a way to manufacture the thing. So I think that is part of their secret. I think the other thing is that design is it's top down there. It's, you know, from Steve Jobs on down. It's not a bunch of executives in a boardroom or marketing people dictating what the product is going to be and then throwing it down to the design department and say, here, make us this thing, or make us a thing like these other guys, the competition has. It really does start with design thinking and design innovation there as the key, and then everything flows from that.
You show in the film the beginnings of a design process. I think it's around toothbrushes and oral hygiene, that most friendly of subjects. And it's about solutions to the problems of oral hygiene, which is one's teeth get dirty, and if they're cleaner, then they get better. It's not about things like visual appeal in a retail context.
Well, I think it is in some cases. I think in the example that we were looking at in the film, it was really about looking at the sort of brainstorming process and an innovation process given a sort of a challenge, which was what's the future, you know, what's the new toothbrush? What, you know, how can you reinvent the toothbrush? You know, the way that that industrial design and product design, that process, the kind of problem solving, you know, methodology of industrial design has sort of evolved into now what is just called design thinking or innovation design. And part of that creative process, in terms of like looking at a particular design challenge, is really thinking, well, do we even need this a new toothbrush? How, you know, what's the real question here? Is the question how can we get people to brush their teeth more, or how do we sell more toothbrushes, or do we even need the toothbrush? What are ways that we can really just, you know, make oral care a better experience so that maybe we don't need to throw away billions of toothbrushes every year? Are there ways that we can change that scenario? And so that's what I was kind of interested in, and why we featured that bit in the film. It wasn't so much let's look at toothbrushes. It was more let's look at the kind of thought process that is behind these designers, and how can that thought process be applied to other areas besides just product design.
Production of The Sound of Young America is underwritten in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com.
Clark Boyd here, host of The World's Technology Podcast. For 4.5 years, I've worked in obscurity, overshadowed by the gadget junkies, the fanboys, the uber geeks. You see, people hate my podcast because, well, I don't talk about iPhones or any other sorts of gadgets and gizmos. In fact, it's the gadgets and gizmos that don't interest me. Now, the people around the world who use them to do cool things, that does interest me. Oh, and I also like bagpipes. Anyway, maybe all of that will interest you, too. Check out the World's Technology Podcast, brought to you by the BBC, Public Radio International, and WGBH Radio in Boston. Find out more at theworld.org/technology.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Gary Hustwit, who you may know as the creator of the typeface documentary Helvetica. His new film is all about design and our interaction with the stuff that surrounds us every day. It's called Objectified. A lot of friendly questions start like this, I have to assure you, but I'm no Marxist, Gary. One thing that I found myself wondering watching the film was... you highlighted a lot of people with wonderful intentions in terms of developing sustainability and so on and so forth. And what I wondered as a non-Marxist, as a capitalist, was whether the rewards system was messed up, whether there was something broken at the beginning, that made it so that the parameters of the problem that designers were solving were wrong. So that, you know, sustainability is a wonderful ideal, but, you know, one wonders if it will really be built into things if the motivator is altruism.
Probably not, you know, because I think it still comes down to kind of a dollars and cents motivation. You know, in a way, we've kind of we've had a broken system for a long time because the manufacturers of all these products sort of get a free ride on the end. They make the things, but then once they're out in the world, they're like, hey, that's, you know, not our problem. Public takes care of it. You know, government takes care of disposing it.
And that there's a cost for raw materials and there's a need to conserve on the front end, but not on the back end.
Sure.
Like IKEA gets its stuff cheap because they use as few parts as possible and they make it with fiberboard and blah, 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 blah. There's no cost to IKEA at the end when it breaks after 2 years.
Sure. So, I mean, that's part of, I mean, in Europe, there are more, there are these, you know, take back laws that have kind of come up on the books where if you make a refrigerator and after that refrigerator is broken, well, you as the, or it's, you know, doesn't work anymore, you know, it's ended its useful life, then you've got to take that back. The company has got to take that product back. And I think you find that when companies are forced to take the things back and disassemble them or get rid of them, suddenly the design of the product to start with will facilitate that a lot easier if they're the ones that are responsible for it. So that's a, you know, it's hard in this economy because nobody wants to talk about, you know, any kind of barriers to selling things and to companies being profitable right now. It's about, let's, you know, get back on track and, you know, have government incentives to buy cars and just buy. It's I think probably not a very popular time to think of putting more restrictions on companies, but, you know, there are so many ways that I think probably that we as taxpayers end up paying for the you know, poorly designed and poorly manufactured products that we don't really think about.
There was a really interesting answer to this profligacy of objects that was presented in your film, which is that you interviewed a couple who do something that I did not even realize existed as a thing. They do design as fine art. You know, maybe design is supposed to be specifically for use. And in fact, I think maybe it was a response to their general artiness and the sort of, you know, self-justification discourse that goes on in the world of fine art. But my pal that I went to see the movie was like angry at them. this couple that do fine art design. And I found myself thinking, like, in a funny way, though, isn't that a way to engage the ideas of design and the process of design without making more crap?
Yeah, no, I think I agree. And in a sense, they're not really doing it as fine art. Rather, they're doing it as art, as kind of criticism, but through actually making things. I mean, they don't sell those things. They're not like in, you know, Sotheby's or something getting auctioned off.
They make these films about interactions with the example you had a robot in it. I don't remember it very specifically, so you'll have to clarify, obviously.
It's about using these kind of theoretical objects or products to kind of explore the different ways that we can or maybe will be interacting with different objects in the future. And that was my main kind of reason for having them in the film. I like the fact that there are people who are thinking about this stuff because, you know, in 20 years, we're going to look back at our iPhones and we'll be laughing. We'll be like, remember the little screen we touched and we stretched out the images and ha ha ha, wasn't that, you know, quaint? Because I think there's so much more in terms of the way we can interact with objects that is we can't even conceive of yet. So I like the fact that there are people kind of making these experimental objects and there's also a real playfulness in what they do too, which again makes us hopefully reconsider or at least think about how we do interact with all these objects every day.
Maybe you have an insight into this. What's the deal with all the chairs? Why does everybody make chairs? Don't we have enough? Don't we have a good handle on the chair at this point?
Yeah.
I mean, there's chair, there's beanbag chair, there's ergonomic chair. Nobody likes beanbag chair or ergonomic chair. So we're just going to stick with chair, right? What's wrong with chair?
I've talked to a lot of designers about it, and in some ways I think it's sort of like a rite of passage or something. Like every designer has to do a chair. You know, obviously, it's one of the most universal objects. We all sit on them every day. And it's kind of a, you know,
at least in a Western context.
Sure. And I think that's an interesting thing to look at too. But, you know, yeah, how many millions of chairs have been designed, and yet there are still really uncomfortable chairs being made, which kind of doesn't make sense. But, yeah, it's that, and then lights too. I think every designer designs some sort of a lamp or lighting fixture at some point.
Is this just because designers just sit around in a chair looking at a piece of paper under a lamp?
You know, the thing that I guess I've figured out about designers, or at least good designers, is that this ability to kind of envision things that don't exist, and this kind of urge to make those things, and or to look at a situation or a challenge in a different way and see that in their head, and then actually kind of go through the steps to make it. So, you know, a lot of times I think that designers kind of have an aesthetic or a way of seeing the world or a philosophy about you know, the things that they want to create. And then it's, you know, sometimes them going through different media and objectifying that philosophy, making it into different things, like a chair or a car or a toothbrush or whatever it is, or whatever they're envisioning. So I think it's about kind of an aesthetic that they're then kind of, you know, exercising in different ways, in different forms.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for being on The Sound of Young America. It was really great to have you on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Jesse.
Gary Hustwit's new film is called Objectified. He's touring it, in fact, all over the world. He's on his way to Korea right now. You can find out more, including if a screening might be coming to a theater near you, at objectifiedfilm.com. It will also be airing on public television as part of Independent Lens in the early winter. That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I have been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our editor is Nick White. Our music provided by Dan Wally. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, where you will find not only The Sound of Young America, but also our other awesome programs like Jordan Jesse Go, our freewheeling comedy talk show. If you have thoughts about the show, you can email me. My email address, my actual email address, the same one my mom uses to email me, is Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, at MaximumFun.org. We'll see you next time, right here on The Sound of Young America.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Proven Winners Colored Choice Shrubs. Their flowering shrubs and evergreens are trialed and tested by expert horticulturists for 8 to 10 years to ensure a beautiful, high-performance display in your landscape or garden. And because the team at Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs is passionate about gardening, they've put together resources to help you get started with garden projects big and small. For example, did you know that hydrangea flower buds form on branches the year before they bloom? With guides like Hydrangeas Demystified, you can learn from the experts and get your questions answered on hydrangea pruning, watering, reblooming, and more. Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs are available in the distinctive white containers at garden centers nationwide, including over 50 varieties of hydrangeas. Learn more at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
When voters talk during an election season, we listen. We ask questions, we follow up, and we bring you along to hear what we learned. Get closer to the issues, the people, and your vote at the NPR Elections Hub. Visit npr.org/elections.